comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are and wherever you happen to be all around this gorgeous planet. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on earth. It's the show where you matter. We're here because you have a right to know. And you know, we examine and expose ourselves to all kinds of information within the genre of the strange and unexplained. And then, you know, we talk about it. We ask questions about it. We listen to what our guests have to say about it, what their answers are. And then it's entirely up to you to do your own critical thinking and decide what you think about the information you've heard. It's our job to bring you all types of information. Tonight, we've got some pretty exciting information we're going to be bringing to you. It involves everything that's fun about our genre. It's sci-fi. It's romance. It's time travel. It's action. It's everything rolled into one. And, well, you'll see. I think you're going to love it. I really do. If you haven't subscribed to the K-Files, that's our free weekly newsletter, be sure you do that. The K-Files comes out each week. We email it to all of our subscribers each week, and we email it only to subscribers who have activated their subscription. So if you haven't subscribed, get over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Right in the middle of your screen, you're going to see in big letters the word K-Files. That's a link. Click it. And when you do, you're going to be asked for your email address. Now, you know, there are some people out there who just think it's a practical joke. It's funny. If they just sign up, they got some friend that they just sign up for everything. Well, that won't work. You know, and here's why. Because the email address that you put in is going to automatically receive an email from us with a link saying if you really intended to subscribe, then you need to click this link and activate your subscription. So that friend that you're spoofing on, when they get that email, they say, I didn't subscribe to that. And so they delete it. So you see, it doesn't work. But if it's you that wants the K-Files, and I hope it is, just put your email address in there. And then when you get that confirmation email from us, click the link, and you'll start receiving one of the best newsletters in this genre. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to, and we never, ever, ever sell, loan, lease, rent, give our email address list to anybody. Okay, it's just for us, for the K-Files. We'd like for you to be getting it. And as I said, it is free. Now, if you're not a member, being a member's not free, but it's pretty darn close. It's 23 cents a day. And if you're a member, then you get to see the show live every night. And you get in on the forums and everything else that we've got. We've got a lot of stuff. So if you're not a member, why not tonight? We'll be back with our guest right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is someone I think all of you know, and I know for sure our regular listeners know, Walter Bosley. Walter Bosley is normally, when he appears on this show, we're talking about something a little bit heavy. And he is someone that I go to as a resource for the show. When we've got something that is kind of deep and kind of heavy, a particular type of topic, because of his background in intelligence. He is former U.S. Air Force OSI, and he can look at things from that perspective and kind of give us some guidance as to whether we're looking at maybe something that is real or something that may be a perception manipulation operation or whatever. But there is a lot more to Walter Bosley than his past with U.S. Air Force OSI. He is a published author, he is a screenwriter, and he is a publisher as well. And what's really cool is what he's just done. He's done something that is really, really cool. A lot of the things that he's talked with us about here on this show have been all wrapped up and packaged up now, and he's included them in a novel. It is called I Will See You in Time. Walter Bosley, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Walter, you know, I've read other things you have written, and you're a good writer.
Thank you.
But I've got to tell you, I just read this book, and what is it, 386 pages?
Something thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah. It's a big book. It's a novel, and it's got something for everybody. And, folks, I'm telling you, this thing is really good. I just read it. Walter, this really ought to be a movie and a television series, something like what we saw with Stargate. You know, we had the Stargate movies, and then we had the series, a couple of different series on television. This book has so many layers to it that you really could do that. And let me also say this, ladies and gentlemen, this book is already available on Amazon as a Kindle book. But even if you don't have Kindle, Amazon, you can download from them free software where you can read a Kindle book on your PC, on your computer. The book is already out there. It's already available. Look, you've got a guy with a background in intel, like you. You've got these sort of threads of romance that keep running through it. You have history, actual history of something that gets woven into the book. You have a stream of the dark side of occultism that runs through this book. You've got ley lines. You've got everything in this book. And folks, listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. It's nothing like the Harry Potter stories. But if you liked the Harry Potter stories, and you would kind of like a grown-up version of all of the wonder and the magic, this is the book. This is the book. It's got it all. Let me now give you the opportunity, Walter, to give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of I Will See You in Time.
Well, first, thank you for that assessment. I really appreciate those kind words. I did work hard on this. This is my first mainstream novel. Those familiar with my other fiction that I write under a pseudonym That's kind of for a niche audience, but this novel, I Will See You in Time, is published under my own name, Walter Bosley, and it is, as I said, my first mainstream novel. It's for general audiences who love time travel romances, time travel adventure stories, and it was written greatly in the tradition of the two gentlemen who are really the modern masters of time travel fiction, and that is Jack Finney and Richard Matheson. Richard Matheson, of course, is well known to everyone as the author of the novel from which Somewhere in Time was taken from. It's a great novel. It's surprisingly also a great movie. Both are classics, and they are different enough that I would urge you to take a look at the book if you haven't read the book. And Jack Finney actually predated Richard Matheson's Somewhere in Time, I think by almost 10 years, with his modern classic Time and Again. Now, I had read both these books when I was younger, and I consider those two books to have been the great modern classics, modern masterpieces of time travel stories. They're similar in that they have a guy who, for whatever reason, for his own reasons, goes back in time and finds romance. And I've always loved that model of story. I love those two stories. And I like their approach. And so when I wanted to write a time travel novel, I decided to really just go back to the two works of time travel fiction that influenced me the most. And in I Will See You in Time, pardon?
I didn't say anything. We're just listening.
Oh, I heard a voice. Sorry. Excuse me. In I Will See You in Time, we have a man who is really unhappy. He's down on his luck. He's unhappy and just doesn't fit in our times. He's a contemporary guy. He lives in our time. And he has a past as a federal agent, past pretty much like mine. He's also got a dismal record where relationships are concerned. And he's just miserable at the beginning of this story, because on top of his personal relationship woes and his coming to the end of one career, here we are, of course, in this economy, and just like many people out there, nothing is happening for this guy. Nothing can seem to go right. So he's really at the lowest point in his life when in steps a gentleman, a very colorful gentleman, a very interesting man, who introduces him to a group. I won't even call it an organization. It kind of stays vague on that regard through the whole book. But to a group of people that know how to use very special carousels located in very special places to travel through time. Now, those of you who, of course, are familiar with me on the show here and have read the Disneyland book will recognize where that's going. Those of you who are not familiar with that, you'll find this to be a real interesting device, so to speak, in how they travel through time. And he learns some things about his past as he joins this group and starts traveling through time, and with each trip he meets some people who you'll recognize, some historical figures, and he gets involved in a situation where he has to save a young woman from a certain doom, and much romance and adventure ensues from there.
Now, you previously have talked with us about ley lines and carousels in reference to your book called Latitude 33, Key to the Kingdom, which we sell on our site.
Yes.
And there is something really, really curious and interesting about that. It shows up Anyone who has read your book, Latitude 33, or who has heard those shows where you talked about that with me, they will recognize it immediately in this novel. They will recognize some of the information, some of the real events being woven into this novel. And I want to talk with you about that just for a little bit. In Latitude 33 and here on the air, you talked with us about the intersection of some major ley lines out in California. They happen to be at Disneyland, and they happen to be directly under where the carousel used to be.
Yes.
Where the carousel originally was built.
Mm-hmm.
It has since been moved a few feet off of center. This carousel was directly over these ley lines, and you told us about how that was not accidental.
Right.
That was planned by Mr. C.V. Wood, formerly of the Stanford Research Institute, who was hired to do the layout for Disneyland. And so he put the carousel right there, and he's got a pretty interesting past. What you told us is that something spinning in a circle above the intersection of these major ley lines, not just there, but anywhere,
right,
seems to be able to create a sort of a time distortion. Okay, now here's what I want to ask you about that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any, in your research, have you found any indication that the carousel above these intersections of ley lines needs to be a certain diameter, or that it needs to spin at a certain speed?
At a certain rate?
Yeah.
Not so much have I found that there's any kind of magic size, magic dimension, or magic speed. Just that all the elements have to come together within their own given situation. How I think works, how I would venture a guess, and how it works in the novel is very much like the phenomenon of torsion, which, of course, your listeners should be familiar with. Torsion related to spin phenomena, specifically the bell, the Nazi bell that Dr. Joseph Farrell has written about at length, and, of course, many others and the early scientists who did things with this, or inventors like Keeley and Tesla and Schauberger and the like. It works on the same principle. You've got the rotating device, and when it's tapped into the energy source, in this case, in the novel's case, and in my theory's case, in Latitude 33, the energy source is the natural telluric currents flowing through what we call ley lines in the Earth. You get that spinning device, and it can really be of any size, any. As far as I know, any speed, it's just doing it right to the... I would say the speed probably varies to the size of the object.
I wonder if there's any sort of known ratio, those who know this secret stuff, I wonder if there's any sort of known ratio between the strength of the ley lines and the size and speed of the carousel.
Well, I would venture a guess that the stronger the ley line source, particularly there has been discussion that, of course, when you have an intersection of ley lines, you've got however many lines are intersecting, you've got that much energy multiplied at the intersection. But then I know that Joseph Farrell and some others have discussed that not only do you have the energy going into it, but then when you put them all together, it generates even beyond that, because basically the whole is more than the sum of its parts. So, that said, it seems like the stronger the energy, say like on an intersection that we're talking about, the device doesn't have to be big to get strong results, measurable results. But think about it, the bigger the device, perhaps the stronger the result.
Yeah. So the device could act as a field disruptor, and it could also act sort of as a capacitor to increase the field.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right. Now, whenever you were talking with us on air about what happened at Disneyland, what happened to you, it was pretty strange. I got to tell you, that was a pretty weird story. And it's in a version of it is in the novel. And what I'm talking about is where you saw this guy at the carousel. He was an old man. Now, we're only about a couple of minutes from break, but go ahead and briefly tell us that story.
Okay, well, in the book, Latitude 33, Key to the Kingdom, I recount my experience, which, by the way, the only authorized place that's selling Latitude 33 is right here at kevinsmithshow.com. That's the only place authorized to sell it. I encountered an old man during my Disneyland experience of 80-81 related to the carousel. And that old man really possessed a lot of synchronicitous traits of Alfred Watkins, the man who is credited with first bringing to the public attention the whole ley line issue in 1928. And I met an old man who was the exact double of Alfred Watkins, told me his name was Alfred at Disneyland in 1980. The problem is Watkins had died many years before.
Okay, so you see this old guy, and he sort of looks like he's dazzled by everything he's seeing.
Yes.
And this is in the book. It's in Latitude 33. It's woven into the fabric of this novel. But just because it's in a novel, folks, don't think this didn't happen. It did happen, and that's why it found its way into the novel. You talked with this guy, and you ended up giving him your, well, Disneyland passport, which means he could ride anything. And then sometime after that is when you discovered his picture in his book about ley lines, right?
Yes, and I was staring at the man that I had met at Disneyland years before, about 11 years before. And what's interesting is the fact that I, for the first time, I saw Alfred Watkins' book with his picture in it.
Okay, we're going to pick up with Alfred Watkins when we come back from this break. We'll be back, folks, on the other side. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is, of course, Walter Bosley. And Walter, when we went away for break, you were telling us about you were looking through a book and you saw this picture, and it was the guy you had seen at the carousel at Disneyland years before. Same guy, same name, but at the time you had seen him, he had been dead for a number of years.
Yes. And
so,
looking at this book, I discovered, I first came upon it, discovered it for myself. It's been a book that's been around for a long time, and you know, it was well known and among people who knew about ley lines. I was new to the subject. In the same year that C.V. Wood, the man who we talked about earlier, you know, I go to at length in the Latitude 33 book that engineered Disneyland and, among many things, placed the carousel on the ley lines, 92 was the year that he died. Well, there's a synchronicity. The year that Alfred Watkins wrote his book, published it, I mean, about the ley lines, the old straight track, was the year that C.V. Wood was born. And the year that I first see the book and recognize the author as the man I saw in Disneyland was the year in which C.V. Wood died. Now, there's a synchronicity there that you could talk about all night, which, you know, is interesting in itself.
Okay, now, let me ask you this. I know that your research took you in the direction of ley lines and manipulation of ley lines via these carousels.
Right.
Isn't it possible, though, that what you saw and what you talked to was just an apparition?
An apparition, or perhaps, as Greg Bishop pointed out to me a few years back, a tulpa. A tulpa is like a little bit more than an apparition. It's something physical that is conjured due to the concentrated energy of the perceiver, the experiencer, on that very thing. And
okay, now let me ask you a question. When you talked,
here's the thing: I had no idea who Alfred Watkins was back in the early 80s. I had no idea who he was until 1992, and here I am conjuring him. That would be the argument that I would say would be against it being a tulpa.
Okay.
As some other phenomenon.
When you talked with this old gentleman, who, by the way, you described as being dressed in a black suit, I think you said, right?
Black suit, white shirt, no tie.
When you talked with him, did you shake hands with him?
I do not recall shaking hands with him, and I cannot recall his voice, other than remembering that it was a gentle voice and that he was he seemed very humbled.
You took your passport, and what did you do with it? Your Disneyland passport. Did you pin it to his jacket?
I pinned it to his jacket. In those days, it was called the unlimited passport ticket, because they still had the ticket books, and you could spend a little extra and get this unlimited use ticket called the passport. And rather than letting it get all crinkled in a pocket and keep having to pull it out, a lot of people would just get a character pin. Mine was Donald Duck. And would just kind of pin it, you know, near their belt or on their shirt somehow, or their jacket. So you just walk in and they see it. So, you know, I want the old guy to lose it. So I, you know, I go there all the time. I've grown up in Southern California. There was a couple hours left before the park closed, about an hour and a half. So, I just pinned it onto his lapel, and he was very grateful. I mean, it was, which, of course, as Latitude 33 discusses, it goes into how I didn't realize it, but that is something that is talked about in the lore of dealing with people from other dimensions.
Okay, so you actually touched his body.
Yes, he was a physical. Oh, and I had two people with me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a physical person, a physical being, and I had two people with me. As this was going on, and again, in Latitude 33, I get into the various possibilities of who my Alfred could have been in relation to Watkins. And what's interesting is that I, you know, in that book I write about that 1981 experience, and this novel came out of research on the Disneyland book. I had just about finished the Disneyland book, and I made one more research trip up to the Bay Area specifically for to wrap up the Disneyland book, to do some related research. And I went up there and visited author Sesh Hari, who your regular listeners are familiar with, and he wanted to show me some ley line sites up there that he had identified. And we went to Pier 39, where there is a carousel right there where the ley line runs through, and that was the reason for going. And while there, I encountered some lucid waking visions, specifically of a woman in an old-time white dress with red hair, and she was walking along a lawn, like in a park, adjacent to the sea or a body of water. And I saw this clearly in my mind's eye as I stood there, but it was not something that I said, I think I'll imagine this scene. No, it was something that just suddenly filled my mind, my consciousness, this vision. It was a waking vision.
And she shows up in your novel as well.
Visiting a ley line site where there is a carousel, and it is there now, Pier 39. This was a few years ago. And there was another site that I almost didn't go to. We had a limited amount of time, a lot to see. And the site up on Twin Peaks, on top of the mountains there, overlooking the city, I kind of could have, I'm like, well, we could, or we could just go to the next site. And he really insisted that we go. And it was up there that I encountered some of the strongest phenomena related to the ley lines in my research.
Okay, now, in the novel, and of course you've talked about that this was your theory, that you get on this carousel and it's perhaps possible to travel into another dimension or another time by getting on this spinning carousel. But now there are other effects of having this spinning carousel, and that is that it sort of spreads this energy around. It kind of makes it wash over Disneyland. And they used to call it the happiest place on earth, and maybe they still do, I don't know. But certainly it was when the carousel was in its original location. Everybody that went to Disneyland had a wonderful time, and every kid in America wanted to go to Disneyland. So it was your theory, though, that by getting on this carousel, it might be possible to actually travel in time or go to another dimension. Now, there are people I know who will say, oh, that's crazy, that's nonsense. Okay, then read the novel and enjoy it as a novel. But there are people who will look at this and say, well, there's got to be something here. I mean, you had this guy from Stanford Research Institute, SRI. They do all kinds of think tank stuff for the government. They do all kinds of super tippy-top secret stuff for the government. And here's this guy from SRI who goes to work for Disney and designs the layout of Disneyland, putting the carousel right on top of these ley lines. Now, there's some evidence that that was not an accident. And in fact, you told me about a place near where I used to live in Arizona called Fountain Hills. And there's a ley line that runs through Fountain Hills. And who was the person who designed Fountain Hills?
Mr. C.V. Wood, the very same man.
Yeah. And I think there were probably some others that you mentioned. He seems to have been very connected and very attuned to this whole thing about ley lines.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Fountain Hills is a rather exclusive area, subdivision or suburb of Phoenix. All right, now, in your novel, your main character has that same encounter with Alfred.
Yes.
At the carousel.
Mm-hmm.
Then he receives a telephone call telling him that this person who's calling him wants to meet him. Tell us about that.
Well, those two events are apart in time, because if you recall, mm-hmm. in the novel, he's remembering back to this experience with this older man before.
And, yeah, yeah.
He receives the phone call, the character, a gentleman named Jack Harvey, the morning after he's essentially hit rock bottom. The novel opens with the main character wanting to die. He's had enough. His world's been turned upside down. He feels helpless. His hands are tied. He can't figure out, you know, how to turn everything around. And for the first time in his life, he wants to die. He just wants to go to sleep and not wake up again. Well, he falls asleep. He gets this call, and this gentleman, Jack Harvey by name, calls him up. They have an interesting conversation, and it ends with Mr. Harvey wanting to meet him at the carousel at Disneyland on a certain day at a certain time. And the main character, the protagonist, goes there and meets this gentleman and learns some very interesting things about the carousels right off. And then they retire to Club 33, those familiar with the park and some of the mystery associated with it. We'll recognize Club 33, and he learns some more and a little bit more about the hero's, direct association with what's going on with these carousels and this group and what this is all about. And it turns out that Jack knows him.
Okay, now Jack knows him, but your character does not realize that Jack knows him.
You might say.
Jack knows him, but your character doesn't know Jack. I mean, he doesn't realize that he knows Jack.
Right, he doesn't realize. And the novel is really about, you know, him realizing who he really is. See, the main character, if you'll recall, the main character goes through a name change.
Yeah.
Now, this is something that I'm not aware is done very much, if at all, except maybe in spy novels, and go figure, with my past. But if you recall, the main character starts with his name, his life, and another name pops up, and this other name, you know, kind of introduces him to his connection. There's something in the past where he's associated to it by another name that initially he doesn't know who the hell that is, and then, as you read the story, he realizes, as you do, how that name came to be associated with him. But that's not where it ends. He actually learns something about the entire scope of his life on Earth and who he was at one point, you know. And we'll kind of leave that there, you know, for those who might want to read the story.
In the novel, well, I'll have to wait because we've just got a few seconds here and then we're into a break. But when we come back, I want to ask you to sort of explain something about getting on these carousels and moving around in time and location. And very, very interesting how that happens. Folks, we got to step away and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest this evening, Walter Bosley. He is the author of a brand new novel that's out there. It is called I Will See You in Time, and that's what we're talking about. It is a novel, and I got to tell you, it is an exceptional novel. But in this novel, he's woven in real facts, real events that have taken place, and it's just fascinating when you see it unfold. Walter, as we went away for break, I said I want to ask you about how these carousels do time travel for this guy. It's not only for him. There are other people using the carousels to do time travel. In fact, he's got a guy trying to hunt him down that's using these carousels. Now, here's the question. He gets on the carousel, and it starts up, it begins to spin, and he describes the sensation as sort of a change begins to take place, and then that change sort of reverses itself, and he's seeing not sort of a, you described it as looking at a kaleidoscope from the side, but it changes back into normal-looking people, normal-looking carousel, except he's in another time.
Right.
How is it that everyone else on the carousel didn't experience that, but he did?
That can be summed up in one word, and that is awareness. These effects, as I talk about in Latitude 33, the nonfiction book, and I want to emphasize that this novel isn't just 380-some-odd pages of Latitude 33. That's only really in the very beginning of the novel. The novel goes way beyond Latitude 33 in what's in there.
Mm-hmm.
But as I talk about in Latitude 33, human consciousness has every bit to do with how these things would work theoretically. The idea in that book is that the carousel was put on the ley line to affect and utilize human consciousness in the effect. Well, in the novel, the thing that makes you able to use these particular carousels, and they've got to be the particular carousels that are located in the special spot, is simply being aware that that's what they are, and that's what they do. And there's something that happens in that human awareness, that consciousness, that makes the difference, that is key, which, you know, is certainly not an original theme with me, because, you know, when you talk about psychic abilities, I certainly believe that everybody has the potential for what we call psychic abilities. It's just, number one, being aware that you can do it, and then, you know, going from there. And in the novel, the fact that he becomes aware of it, because the character you're talking about that's hunting him down, an interesting character who goes by the name Straps, his name is Straps McDonald in the novel, and he simply learns how to do this when he becomes aware that that's what these particular carousels can do.
Now, folks, I talked with Walter today, this afternoon, and I told him, I'm going to ask you that question tonight. And I told him, don't tell me the answer right now, because I am going to ask it on air, and I've got a theory about it, and I'm going to say on air what my theory is, and we'll just see how close I got.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on how you look at it as to how close I got. My theory was this, that because of his background, being an intel, he's dealt with a whole lot of really strange stuff that a lot of people would think is paranormal. And that his mind is receptive to that because he's encountered that before. So, okay, not exactly on target there, but not too far off target.
No, it has to do with awareness. In your theory, he's aware of certain things, so therefore he's open to the possibilities, and therefore in tune. It works like a spectrum. There's a spectrum of sound. Well, we can only hear so much. Animals can hear more, like dogs famously can hear things higher on the sound spectrum. That's why dog whistles are silent to us, but dogs hear them.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar with light. I would say that the light spectrum has to do a lot, I think, with people when they see apparitions and things or other things. That simply, you know, we can only see so much on the light spectrum. So, but there may very well be more there. And certainly there are, you know, scientifically, you know, levels of the light spectrum which the human eye, you know, can't really detect. So I think I'm speaking generally in to make a point, to illustrate a point in principle, is that human consciousness and awareness really unlocks a lot. And in this novel, that's really an operating factor.
Now, at the beginning of the show, I said that if you like the Harry Potter movies, and there, look, I know those are supposed to be kids' movies, but do you think kids have 10, 15, 20 bucks to pop out there for tickets? I mean, little kids don't have that kind of money. Mom and dad are paying for that. And so there's lots and lots of parents, lots of teenagers, and lots of people that are not parents and not teenagers, full-grown people that went to see Harry Potter, made it one of the most successful movie series ever. And I said, if you liked Harry Potter, you're going to love this. It's not like Harry Potter, but it's kind of all the mystical and magical and wonderment that you see in Harry Potter, but it's in a whole different setting and a whole different plot. But one of the things that you have in your novel is this. He is told, your character, Jack or John, he goes by both names, which, by the way, when I saw that, I said, well, you know, we had President John F. Kennedy, and what did everybody call him? Jack.
Jack. Yeah. Well, Jack and John are separate characters, of course. There's Jack Harvey, yeah. And there's John, the hero. But remember, he starts the book out, his name is Don.
Yeah.
Don Finney, which is a little nod to Jack Finney.
Yeah. But, he is told by this, what's his name, Jack Harvey?
Jack Harvey, yes.
Yeah, your character is told that if you get in trouble, no, he's not told by Jack, I don't think. Somebody tells him, if you get into some kind
Jack.
Of trouble,
if you get into trouble,
go to the train station, right? And if it gets to be more than you can stand, go for the brass ring.
Mm-hmm.
But he's told, you know, if you get lost, you go to the train station.
Mm-hmm.
And in Harry Potter, of course, that train takes them from the real world into the mystical world. What's the role of your train? Why do we go to the train station?
I love travel by train, and I love train stations. And in the novel, they don't necessarily, you know, when they tell them to go to the train station, of course, they don't necessarily take the train, but certainly they could. But that's the meeting point if you're, you know, one of these members of this group, an agent in this group that you're traveling through time. And, you know, if there's a train station, and again, as you said, Kevin, you know, you need help. Go to the train station, and you're right, the train is the symbol, and the train station is really the symbol of kind of, you know, where all roads cross.
Is there any explanation in your book as to how this Jack Harvey knows everything about this guy?
No, and that's the beauty. The assumption, the implication is that they actually have a past, that they've worked together, and Jack, you know, kind of alludes to in the book.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll pick up there when we come back. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Walter Bosley, and we're talking about time travel. We're talking specifically about his novel, but in general, we're also talking about the real stuff having to do with time travel. It's very interesting. Your main character gets, and I'll use his second name, John. He gets onto the carousel for the first time after he's informed of its time travel properties. Mm-hmm. And it happens. And throughout the novel, he's moving forward and backward in time and location. He's moving around in location by using these carousels.
Right.
Walter, let's step out of the novel for a moment. And let's talk, well, we'll use that concept, but let's step out of the novel. Let me ask you, how genuine, how real do you think that is as a possibility to actually travel through time or into other dimensions by using these carousels that are on these ley lines? How real is that?
Well, I can tell you about my personal experiences with some experiments that I've been running. I won't go into the full detail on it. I'm not ready to talk about that if I ever do. But when I was doing the wrap-up for the Latitude 33 book that led to the information that led to this novel, I started doing some experiments on an old carousel located near Ley Energy, out near where I live, and I had what I think was an experience with seeing to the past and another location. I did multiple rides on this old carousel in question and had an unexpected insight, you might say vision, we'll call it, a lucid waking vision, of a little girl on a boardwalk near a lake area, which resembled, one of our inland lakes, like in Utah or something, you know, in one of the more inland states, not on the coast. And it was of another time of you know, maybe 100 years before. And if you recall, I even used that inspired a scene in the novel when he goes to San Diego in 1927 and steps off the carousel and bumps into this little girl and she loses her balloon. That experience of having that lucid vision, that was something that I did experience, and I noted it in my notebook, on my personal notebook on this research. And I'm very keen to go back and do more of this kind of experimentation and do it on more of these old carousels located on or near enough the ley lines. But of course, in the novel, I'm dramatizing the effect, you know, to tell a story and make it more exciting. But I do think that there's definitely something to being able to see, like remote viewing or other things where your consciousness taps into something very real that is beyond your physical self. I think that's very possible on these carousels, that you can have an experience in consciousness with this. As far as physically being able to, as I talk about in Latitude 33 and as I dramatize in the novel, of course I'd love to think that's possible. I'll tell you what, if I do that, I'll let you know. I may not let everybody know, I might just let you know, but it's an intriguing idea. Certainly.
All right, now back to the novel.
Mm-hmm.
This novel, for someone like me that talks with people about all kinds of topics related to the strange and unexplained, mm-hmm. and talks to these people all the time, obviously I think in layers about this.
Mm-hmm.
So I read the novel, and then questions come to me, and here's one of them. He gets on the carousel, and he leaves the current time, and bam, he's back. I mean, he goes back in time.
Mm-hmm.
But the question then is, is it only going back in time, in other words, linear travel backward in time on the same timeline, or is he on another timeline but in the past?
Go ahead, finish your question.
That's it.
I actually, and it's not that I'm opposed to, you know, alternate myriad choices of different timelines, but I'm personally a fan of, you know, I guess I keep it simple. That's why I'm talking about the tradition of Jack Finney and Richard Matheson, which I was looking at my novel as I was attempting to write, you know, the next great, the next good one, I hope, of that vein. And I like the, essentially, there's one timeline we're talking about here. There's no alternative timeline. I tend to like that, and that's my tendency. However, when you're dealing with a time travel story, and I found myself also, there it is, at one point, you know, there, he does go back onto the timeline to change the outcome of something. Now, here's what's interesting. In the one instance, and I won't go too deep into it, you got to read the book. In one instance, he doesn't do it. He's not really able to do it. In the other instance, he kind of does. And you just kind of have to, you know, to take it. When you're in the flow of the story, you know, I think the other little details sufficiently explain why it happens. But it's very hard to write a time, you know, travel story in the way, you know, the kind of, that I was writing without tinkering a little bit. But as far as getting really deep into, well, there's several John Adeers out there, and there's several storylines with him and the Olivia character, or him and the Cora character. I just don't get into that too deeply, because that can be confusing when you're trying to tell a story. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of there, the multiple timeline thing, but mostly it's not. Does that answer your question?
It does. Now, in some ways, you know, I talked about people that like Harry Potter. If you like Doctor Who, you will like this. But he's not your character is not a time lord.
No.
You know how Doctor Who travels all forward and backward in time and all this strange stuff. The character in your book is traveling forward and backward in time as well.
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting that he makes the observation that, you know, he's back in 1906, I believe, and he makes the observation that there's really not much different. The clothing is different, the technology is different, but the sounds and the people are really just the same. And, you know, I've wondered if that would be the case. If you traveled back in time, would people be all that much different? And I've come to the conclusion that, no, we're not. We have, we're not much different from people 100 years ago. We have better toys. We have better technology. But we're still pretty much the same as people as those folks were.
However, I would like to point out a difference, though, and the novel does emphasize this. In fact, this is the very reason for the being of the character John. The point that you're making is that he discovers, we have a tendency to think that we're in modern times, we're so much infinitely smarter and wiser than people 100 years ago, 50, 100, you know, 1,000 years ago or whatever. And the point in the novel is, oh, no, we're not. They are just as human as we are. They have just the same, you know, intelligence quotient as we do. They have the same motivations. They're just like us, but like you said, their toys are different and their clothes are different. However, one thing that is emphasized in the novel is their values, what they value in their society, what they value around them. He prefers the values and the tastes of, you know, roughly, you know, the 100 or so years, give or take a few decades ago, over our era. And that point is emphasized heavily. He spends the first part of the novel, as you recall, as a pretty unhappy, grouchy guy.
Yeah.
Until he starts traveling through time, and that's his emotional motivation. And I think that goes back to explain or to further illuminate why the going back, why not so much going forward. Well, this particular story deals with a man who would rather be in the past in some regards, and yet, if you recall, there's a couple of scenes in there where he realizes his modern, our contemporary sensitivities and values on certain social things are much more improved than some people's of 100 years ago. And there's a scene in the San Francisco, the Belladonna Hotel Casino, that specifically emphasizes that. And I won't say any more.
Well, and he's not preachy about it either, but it does come through.
It's not, but there, you know, he does make the point that you made, but then also I want to emphasize, because that's part of the reason I wrote it, is that there's an elegance lost in our modern world. There used to be an elegance to things, the mundane things, and we lost it. Our world, in comparison, became an ugly place to look at, in comparison, and that is emphasized in the story.
There is a scene, and I won't give too much of this away, but I say a scene. There is an event that happens where a guy is beating up on a black prostitute, and he hears her screaming, and he steps in, and he stops it, and you can see in what he has to say and in what his actions are that his sensitivities about racism are those of modern times.
Yes,
that he's taken back in time with him. And he's like I say, he's not preachy about it. He just brings the situation to a halt.
And I'd like to emphasize, too, mention that he's not, I am not, through this character, making a statement that everybody back then shared the attitudes of this particular character. But, you know, I was trying to emphasize what a jerk Straps McDonald is. And he's the kind of guy that would have held these attitudes, points of view that really needed to go away. And it's a nice little tense, colorful, and interesting moment, I think, which kind of shows the character John that, okay, stuff from our era isn't, you know, attitudes and certain things about contemporary people aren't so bad either, you know. Mm-hmm. So you see the character go through an arc of, he really starts out cynical, just cynical, and you know, angry and unhappy, and as he goes through, he works out something that has haunted him regarding a woman and women in general, something that's haunted him, and then kind of gets his hope rejuvenated, and that's where there's a heavy romantic theme through this novel. But female readers should love this.
Well, I'll tell you what.
The beginning, when he's grouchy and you know, might appear misogynistic, because he sure as hell does not end up that way.
Well, his opinion of women at the beginning of this novel is really nasty.
Negative.
It is.
He's gone through, you know, it's, and you know, you do that to make a point, you know, as an author, through the character, to illustrate a point in the character.
But he is quite changed.
The female characters in this novel are very important and colorful and strong in some cases. And
You have a female character in this novel who is a historical character that really was a victim of a very strange crime.
Yes.
And you and I have talked about that case, as a matter of fact, in detail while you were investigating it.
Yes.
Do you care to tell us anything about that?
I've been talking about goes deeply into all that, and it'll be coming out hopefully soon. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you've got a nonfiction book about that crime that's mm-hmm. coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we won't get into that too much.
Right.
But we'll get into it as much as your novel does.
Mm-hmm.
In this setting, in the novel, she is referred to as our agent by Jack Harvey.
Yes.
So she's referred to as being affiliated with this group in sort of an official capacity. And yet it's not an official group.
Right.
Who are these people, this group?
They are a group of knowledgeable individuals who operate just like an intelligence organization. They have their agents. They have their agents that are really just sources. They have people who work with them, as you read in the novel, who aren't really aware that these guys are time travelers, but they help them in their own times. They know that they're helping some type of, you know, they believe some type of government agency. And ostensibly it is, you would assume that it is, it's implied. It's a mysterious group, and that's the way I wanted it to be. Should I write another novel, you know, with this storyline, with these characters, I would get into that more. But I thought it was a lot of fun just to keep it somewhat vague and mysterious, yet recognizable in how they operate. And
well, you certainly did that.
The female character you're talking about, Cora, she is one of those field sources who helps them in her own time, within the frame of her own time. But of course, we learn a little bit more about her, and she learns quite a bit more about John and the group and what they do. But you've got to read the story to find out what she learns and what her ultimate fate is.
Yeah, you actually use some of the real names from that real crime in your novel.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Police Chief Shea was really the police chief of San Bernardino. He was the police chief for a while, but he was also the sheriff. He'd been a sheriff deputy from the time he was a young man. He's a law enforcement legend in San Bernardino County in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. A radio show my father used to listen to when he was a boy, a little kid, called The Sheriff, the stories were taken from the files of Walter Alexander Shea, Police Chief Shea, and he's a very active character in the novel. Also, Mark B. Shaw, a man who he was a mortician, and the company that bears his name is still in existence. When my father died and we did his funeral, we did it through the Shaw Mortuary. And Mark B. Shaw was an interesting guy who had been a missionary in India and then came to the United States, became a U.S. citizen. He was a chaplain for the cavalry, and very interesting guy. But he was also interested in very esoteric things, probably inspired by his time in India. Even though he was a Baptist minister, he left the ministry to become a mortician, and that's kind of an interesting choice, which we get into deeply into the nonfiction book. And then, of course, he is in the novel, and he ends up kind of partnered up with another interesting figure from history who has a historical connection to San Bernardino because he spent 3 years here, and that is the Reverend Dr. Walter Franklin Prince, who Houdini fans and readers of Kalish and Sloman's book, The Secret Life of Houdini, will recognize as the man who was the head of the American Psychical Research Society, and teamed up with Houdini and the others in his battle against the corrupt spiritualists, which, of course, you will find in my novel.
Oh, they play a huge role. Book.
And they are named as well. Some of the more known characters in that drama are also in the novel. So, absolutely. This time travel novel certainly includes people who actually lived. And you can kind of take it as a little teaser for the nonfiction book that I've been researching, investigating, and writing over the last couple of years.
Well, you know, the nonfiction book is going to be a blazing book itself. I know that because, like I say, you and I have sort of delved into the central crime that that book will be exposing and investigating. And we've spent actually quite a long time on the telephone talking about that crime and examining, well, if this piece of evidence is there, what about this and what does that mean?
Right.
We've just sort of analyzed that evidence from time to time,
mm-hmm.
verbally over the telephone.
Right.
So that's going to be a great book. But this spiritualist group that is at the core of the darkness in your novel.
Yeah.
They actually existed.
Mm-hmm.
And in your novel, they continue to exist into the future, back into the future. Are they still in existence today?
Well, jumping over to the nonfiction book and that investigation, I suspect that, yes, the core group that's behind the crimes exist in some form today. Yes, I do. My co-author Richard Spence and I suspect that they do indeed exist. The novel, of course, you know, the novel doesn't go too much into what we would call the future. The novel pretty much takes place mostly between 1906 and 1915, with intermittent forays into the 20s, 30s, and 40s, just for purposes of moving my character through time and place.
Yeah, but when I'm talking about it, it comes forward into the future. I'm talking about when we first see the spiritualist group, we see them again later, and it is now future from that time.
Yes, absolutely, because they are, you know, kin to the spiritualists who I agree with those who put out the theory, the particular spiritualists, not all of them, but the particular spiritualists involved in the murder of Harry Houdini. I do drink that Kool-Aid. I do buy into that theory. I do believe, even as an investigator, especially as a trained investigator experienced, that Harry Houdini was indeed murdered, and it was by these people. I mean, my gosh, read Kalish and Sloman's book on that issue, and you'll see, you know, their handprints all over it, and their pride. I kind of, you know, essentially, one of the figures in the Houdini drama is kind of, two of the figures in the Houdini drama, actually, one man and his close associate, are the main, they are among the main villains of the story. There's one background character, there's one character that is kind of an eternal evil type of character.
All right, we have to step away for break, Walter. We'll be back right after this. Thank you. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Walter Bosley. And Walter, when we went away for break, I was sort of examining that thing about the spiritualist group, if they're still around, and you were talking about a particular spiritualist group that had been involved in the murder of Harry Houdini. Let me let you finish your thought on that, and then I've got a question about a particular symbol that's mentioned in your book.
Okay. Specifically, when we went into the break, I was talking about Dr. Leroy Crandon, who those familiar with the Houdini drama will recognize as the husband of Marjorie Crandon, whom all the controversy was surrounding when Houdini and Walter Franklin Prince and others were investigating her corrupt practices, or for corrupt practices. And Dr. Crandon is one of the villains of the novel. He and another known associate of his, and they are in league with corrupt members of a spiritualist temple in San Bernardino nearly a century ago, in my novel, in the context of my novel. And so there's another, and Crandon was a historical figure. And I will, again, you can read about his nefarious record elsewhere. But that's where I was going with that, was just identifying.
Okay, now, this particular symbol is mentioned by the police chief, Walter Shea. And he's talking about a local man who was found dead. His hand was near his mouth with a gun laying next to his body.
Yeah.
And there is a symbol inscribed on his hand. It's a circle. Did I read that correctly?
Part of the audio broke in that sentence. You said there was...
Yeah, there was a symbol inscribed on the victim's hand, the man who was found dead.
Mm-hmm.
It was a circle.
Okay.
Now, did I read that correctly? Because I was reading fast.
Well, yes, but that's one of those things we probably it's one of those things that isn't overtly explained or overly described in the novel. It's kind of a background texture symbol, if that makes any sense.
Okay. Now, I happen to know, because of a very long conversation we had last year, about a symbol similar to this. I happen to know about that, but in the context of the novel, and I don't know, maybe that's going to be in your nonfiction book, but in the context of the novel, I wondered if that symbol, because it's a wheel, a circle, was in any way tied to any meaning about the carousels?
Oh, certainly, yeah. It's all, but in a way that is certainly thematic, let's say, as it is specific.
You have one of my favorite characters of history that shows up in this book as well. Maybe surprising to people when I say this, but Wyatt Earp shows up.
Yeah. And Wyatt Earp has a historical connection to San Bernardino. One thing I'd like to say that I present San Bernardino, which has become the butt of many jokes for Southern California. It used to not be the case, and the nonfiction book goes into that quite a bit. And if you study the history, some people would be very surprised to find I was that San Bernardino was one, the garden spot of Southern California. It was a different place. It was the place in Southern California, before Los Angeles certainly ever was, that people traveling from all over wanted to come to, because this park that's in the novel, that features prominently also in the nonfiction book, but is in the novel quite a bit, Urbita Springs Park was the Disneyland of its day. It had an amusement park with rides. It had a zoo. It had live music. It had a large lake. It was just this amazing place, and San Bernardino itself was this wonderful, wonderful city, and it's quite the different image than what we have now.
Well, what I wanted to ask you about Wyatt Earp, isn't it true that when he retired from law enforcement, that eventually he wound up moving to California? And then the question is, was it San Bernardino that he moved to?
He spent time in and around San Bernardino, had a house in town. You got to understand, when he was a youth in his early teens, his father and their family had a ranch right up the street in the vicinity of Yucaipa, which is between San Bernardino and Palm Springs, but like just right beyond Redlands. In I believe the Live Oak Canyon area, they called it. But the Earp family had a ranch there. Now, Virgil, I believe it was Virgil, when he left Arizona, he came to Colton, which is essentially a next-door neighbor suburb of San Bernardino, where he was the constable or sheriff for a while. And he was buried right over here in what's now a historical cemetery called Agamanza. And I grew up, you know, every once in a while, if we were driving by Agamanza, we'd stop by or we'd drive by. It's like, hey, that's where Virgil Earp is buried. You know, Wyatt Earp's brother, Virgil, who was at the gunfight at the OK Corral. Mm-hmm. So the Earps have had essentially a lifelong association with this area. And Wyatt Earp, you know, and his wife Josie, if you recall the mm-hmm. you know, the story, yeah. And of course the movies of recent years, they spent quite a bit of time in San Bernardino County, and of course, you know, some time in town. They were a fixture for a while, in a way.
Well, even though he shows up in the story, folks, this is not a Western novel. It's not a Wild West novel, by a long shot. One of the curious things that's in the novel, though, that I really liked, you know, I'm an ex-cop, and there's a little exchange between the police chief, Walter Shea, and your main character, John. So Shea sort of chuckles about 20th century policing and how, you know, they're saying things are changing and so forth. And he kind of indicates that maybe he thinks 20th century policing wasn't all it was cracked up to be. And the exchange has to do with element of surprise versus not having the element of surprise. And more specifically, he's kind of chafing about the fact he has to wear a uniform now.
Right, yes. He's a policeman, not a sheriff's deputy.
Yeah.
During that period of his life, he eventually, after that, became elected sheriff and was the county sheriff again and such. But still, he was, by that point in his life, you know, he's the head sheriff, and he wore a suit and such. He hated automobiles. That's in the novel. Mm-hmm. But in real life, he didn't care for cars. So he had them on his department and on his police force, but sheriff's department and police force, but he'd have someone drive him around. But it was an interesting...
Well, I like this guy already, you know.
He also brought fingerprinting to law enforcement in San Bernardino County.
Well, you know, I have something in common with him other than just being a cop.
Nonfiction book, The Murders That Occurred.
I have something in common with him other than just being a cop. I also hate to drive. I can do it, and I've done it for years and years and years, but I really don't like driving. And I think it's because all those years as a cop, getting up every day, strapping on a gun, putting on a vest, put the uniform on, you know, and get out there and climb in a car and drive for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours every single day. Now, some people like it. To me, driving is just like going to work.
Yeah,
I just, in fact, I've told you that before.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't care for driving. Walter, you've got so many themes woven into this novel that come from real stuff.
Right.
And yet you've said that you're not really trying to make a statement with this novel.
In what, not trying to make what kind of statement?
Well, you said earlier you're not trying to make a statement. It, you know, that it's a novel. It's for enjoyment. Are you trying to make a point with this novel?
I believe in what makes the best fiction when you're a writer is, you know, they say you write what you know, and what that means is you take your own experiences and you use them. The more dramatic ones, or you take your experiences and you alter them however you need to do to crank up the drama. This is why, you know, a lot of times, a lot of writers, not every writer, of course, but a lot of writers tend to not write their truly best stuff until they reach a certain age, because, you know, you got to live a few years, you got to experience life to get the balance of experience and, you know, what you'd like to think is wisdom and reflection more is what it is. You know, occasionally you get the younger prodigies who write something, but they always write what they know. You know, every good writer, or every time a writer has written something that ends up being good, knock on wood, is really when you stick to writing what you know. And that usually means drawing from your personal life, your personal ideas. And you take those experiences and those ideas, and they're really supposed to serve the story. They're supposed to serve the action, serve the experience for the reader. So certainly I take things you'll recognize as my experiences and ideas and attitudes, but I also try to pull stuff out you haven't heard of. The character of Olivia, who is, well, I don't want to say too much, but she's based on a real person in my life. So.
Okay, now we've got about a minute and a half here. Let me ask you this. We've talked about that the carousels are used by your character and others in the novel to do time travel. In reality, do you, now I've asked you, do you think time travel on these carousels is in reality possible? And you've answered that. But do you think that back out here in the real world with these carousels on ley lines, is it time travel that might be possible? Or is it dimensional travel that would happen?
Well, time is a dimension. I believe time is like a physical dimension which can be visited like a place. So it's both separately, yes, the answer is yes, but I see them more as a together, yes. And when we come back, your prior question has led me to want to clarify something, because even though I may not be trying to make a point with the novel as such, but experience the reader,
Walter, I wish we had more time. We don't. We have stepped away for break. I'll let you pick up right there when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on Final Approach. The end of the show is racing toward us. My guest this evening, Walter Bosley. Walter, you were making a point when the break took over. I want to give you a chance to finish your thought.
Yes, I was saying that even though the point of writing the novel is to entertain the reader and maybe to, you know, throw some thought-provoking ideas the reader's way, for me, my personal reason was to get some things on paper that include certain ideas I certainly have about the past, time travel, past lives, and such, but also there's some very personal things in this novel that came from what I believe is fact. For example, the research I was doing, the lucid waking visions I was telling you about earlier, we were talking about earlier, when I was visiting the ley lines in the Bay Area, these all came to me before I ever decided to write a novel. This stuff was coming to me, and it was only after I had these experiences that I believe were visions of true events that I decided, you know, later, I'll go ahead and include this in a novel, these things in a novel. And one of them, I will tell you this, to whet your appetite a little bit, because this is kind of depicted in the novel in a dramatic way. When I visited Indian Rock over in Berkeley, this was in the fall of 2007, and on that day that I'd visited Pier 39 and Twin Peaks and started having these interesting visions, as I stood there, I saw in my mind, I watched San Francisco burn in the aftermath of the 1906 earthquake. Now, this was quite astonishing to me. I saw it in my mind. I'm standing there on Indian Rock, looking across the bay, looking at the, I see the modern city, but at the same time, I was seeing in my mind clearly a picture of the city burning after the 1906 earthquake, and felt the emotions associated with that. And I believe that I was seeing something that I had watched before in 1906. And there's another aspect of the story that's in the novel that, I believe was a revealing lucid vision of a real association in my past, it has to do with this particular woman in my past, and the modern experience in this life went a certain way, and it was kind of an anomaly for me, and I never could quite explain it. And when I went up there and had this experience, and I was essentially, by standing on the lines, shown what had happened 100 years before, I believe that what I saw was something I had experienced before in a past life, and I decided to use that in the novel. And that has to do with what happens with the character Olivia, and I don't want to go into that too much, but it has to do with the character Olivia in San Francisco.
Well, I'll tell you what, this novel, for anyone who likes novels, you gotta like this. If you like sci-fi, you gotta like this. If you like romance, you gotta like this. If you like action, you gotta like this. And
H.P. Lovecraft, there's some stuff in there for H.P. Lovecraft fans.
Okay. Now, we have a number of movie producers that listen to this show. We have a number of TV producers that listen to this show. And all I can say, guys and gals, you need to call Walter Bosley. You need to get in touch with him. You need to get your hands on this book, for one thing. And somebody needs to wrap up the rights for this. I want to see this on the big screen. And then I want to see a series on television. And I want to tell the audience, I don't get any commission. I don't get paid for saying this. I get no commission out of the sales of this book. There's no financial arrangement whatsoever. I'm telling you, from me to you, it's a great book, and it really deserves to have you buy it and read it, and it deserves to have movie producers and TV producers buy the rights and produce it. This, I think, would be a great hit. I really do. I think it's good stuff. Now, let me also say this. Some authors write like I do in very direct, very short clipped statements. But I don't write novels, okay? When you read this novel, it's very visual. Sights, sounds, colors, even smells are described in such a way that you feel like you're in the scene. You feel like you're there. So I think anybody would enjoy reading this. Anybody. It is called I Will See You in Time. You can get it at Amazon.com. And you need to go there and purchase it. It is in Kindle format, but you can download free software to your computer where you can then read Kindle books on your computer. So I recommend that you do it. Walter has experienced, like so many authors, especially in our genre, what it's like to be ripped off by people who say, well, I just want to get the word out. And so what they do is they steal one of his books and they post it somewhere for people to download for free. They've done that with Latitude 33. Walter has sent legal notices to a bunch of these people, and just one site had so many downloads, Walter lost a minimum of $85,000 out of his pocket because some jackass said, I just want to get the word out. Well, Walter wants to get the word out, but if you want to get the word out, don't kill the goose that lays a golden egg. If you put movie producers, DVD producers, and authors out of business by posting their stuff for free download when that's how they have to make their living, when you do that, you put them out of business. And they can't keep getting the word out, okay? When you go to one of those sites and download it for free, that's theft. And you're stealing right out of the author's pocket. I know you don't intend it that way, but that's what it is. It's theft. And you steal right out of his pocket, and you put him out of business where he can't write you another book, okay? So go over to Amazon and purchase the book, I Will See You in Time. And that helps keep Walter in business. He didn't ask me to do this. I'm just doing this on my own. He's probably embarrassed by me bringing it up. But listen, I know a filmmaker, a top filmmaker in our genre, who will never make another film in our genre because this was done to him twice. And it's cost him hundreds of thousands of dollars. And he has written off the UFO community, the paranormal community. And he says, no way, no more.
I would like to add that it's not just of course, you know, it's a way people have chosen to make a living, but also, you know, your more talented, creative people are not going to be interested in creating or presenting the more fascinating things if, you know, if it's going to be stolen, if it's going to be expected to be free to everybody. Why bother? Why do the work to share with everybody? You know, to write these books, particularly nonfiction, you know, it's more than a full-time job, but it's at the very least like a full-time job. You're putting hours and hours of your thought, and that's really the way it's packaged is what you've written, and that's your intellectual property. But there's generations out there that think, you know, one of them, the motto on their website is, you know, keeping knowledge free. Well, that's great.
I wish we had more time, but the end of the show has taken over. Walter, thanks for being with us. Stay on the phone with me for just a moment. Folks, go get the book. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.